Those of you who've been in church, who are regulars here, will know that for the last year, we've been kind of walking our way through Paul's first letter to the Corinthians. And probably many of you, if not all of you, will be thinking that a year is a long time to spend talking about Paul's first letter to the Corinthians. What we need to understand, however, is that the Christians in Corinth were talking about the letter for an awful lot more than 1 year. In fact, this letter that Paul writes that we've spent so much time looking at continued to raise issues in the Corinthian fellowship to such a degree that Paul had to write another letter later to deal with some of the issues that they hadn't quite got sorted out as a result of this one. So when I think about that, I don't feel so bad about the fact that we've actually taken a little bit of time to walk slowly through this. We haven't done this in worship for a long time, spent time kind of getting immersed in a book and trying to find out its background and understand what it's all about and try to apply it to our own situation. I don't feel so bad about it because the Corinthians were thinking about this for an awful lot longer than 1 year. But this is now the end, okay? So gird up your loins. One more Sunday and we're done this week and next week. And in a moment or two, as you'll find out next Sunday, Paul is going to take the pen from his secretary who's been writing this letter as he dictated it, and he's going to sign it for himself. So the last few verses, which we didn't read a moment or two ago, are actually written in Paul's own handwriting, and he signs his name at the bottom so that when it arrives in Corinth, they will recognize his handwriting and know, yeah, this is the real thing. This is from Paul. This isn't somebody else trying to masquerade as Paul. So before he takes up the pen and signs off the letter at the end, we have these verses we read a moment or two ago. And in these verses that we've just read, you will realize that Paul is mostly talking about travel plans and about people. So he's talking about what he hopes to do over the next number of months, and not only himself, but also Timothy and Apollos, whom they had asked about, and a few others, and he gives information about that. But there is one theme that runs through the 18 verses, and it's a theme that we hate to talk about in church. Now, it's not politics, and it's not sex. It's money. Okay, and I know we hate to mention it and we hate to talk about it in church, but actually it's the connecting link between a number of the things that Paul has to say here. He comes to this final question. Now, you've been walking with us through Corinthians. You know by now that in this letter, Paul is responding to some correspondence that has come from the Corinthians to him. And what we discovered as we looked at the letter was that in the second half of the letter, every time Paul says something like, now about this, what he is doing is responding to a question that the Corinthians asked him. And we've seen that through a number of the sections in the letter. And this section starts with, now about the collection for the Lord's people. The Corinthians raised this issue of money with Paul. The collection for the Lord's people. This was the collection for the church in Jerusalem. The poor who were there needed to be supported, and it was a kind of a key plank of Paul's ministry. Almost everywhere he went, he sought to get people to support the needs of the poor in Jerusalem. He mentions it probably 4 times in his letters. One of the references is slightly cryptic, but it looks like in 4 different letters he mentions this issue. Now, we don't know why the Corinthians raised it with Paul. But that they had raised it with Paul gave him the opportunity to reiterate its importance and to set out some practical details about how to get the offering together and then about how the offering would be transmitted to the people who needed it in Jerusalem. Now that's how chapter 16 of the letter begins, as Paul responds to the question that he's been asked. But the interesting thing is, that Paul doesn't just mention Christian giving once in this section. He mentions it 3 times. He mentions it 3 times. The first time is the offering for the poor in Jerusalem. But then the second time he mentions it has to do with his own personal, Paul's own personal need of financial support. 1 Corinthians 16, verse 6, he says, perhaps I will stay with you for a while or even spend the winter so that you can help me on my journey wherever I go. What was he talking about there? He was talking about the fact that he was asking the Corinthian church to meet his expenses on his journey to wherever it was God was calling him after that. So he was asking for financial support. That's the second time. The third time he mentions it is in respect of Timothy, who he was sending to them. He couldn't come himself because if he came now, he couldn't stay very long, and he wanted to be in a position to spend some time in Corinth when he did come. So he said, I'm not going to come yet, but I am sending Timothy to you, and he'll update you on the issues that we're talking about. So he says, when Timothy comes, verse 11, no one then should treat him with contempt. See him on his way in peace so that he may return to me. Paul was currently in Ephesus. He was working and preaching there, founding a large congregation in Ephesus. He was going to send Timothy down to Corinth. Timothy's expenses in getting to Corinth and in living while he was in Corinth were being met by the church in Ephesus. So what's Paul saying to them here? It's your responsibility to make sure that Timothy has all the resources he needs to get his way back to me in Ephesus when his work is done. That's the third occasion in which he was asking people to give. And then, as if that's not enough, he goes on to remind them of a shining example in their own midst of a leader whose willingness to share his resources with the fellowship in Corinth was well known to them. Verse 15, you know that the household of Stephanas were the first converts in Achaia, and they have devoted themselves to the service of the Lord's people. Christian giving is at the heart of this passage. The importance of it ties together most of the things that Paul's talking about in these verses. And we could spend what time I have left talking about Christian giving, but I'm not going to do that. So you can put your purse back in your bag and close up your wallet in your pocket. I'm not going to ask you to give to the Lord's work as a result of these verses. I could do that, but I'm not going to do that. Because I want you to see something else. I want you to see what Paul says in the context of Christian giving about some things that are key to being a member of the church. I want you to see two things that Paul says here that he reminds us we are called to as members of the fellowship of his people. The first one is this: we are called to commit. We are called to commit. When Paul invites the Corinthians to get involved in giving to Jerusalem and in giving to Timothy's needs and in giving to his own needs, what is Paul really doing? Think about that for a moment. No one ever really gives for the sake of giving. No matter what it is, whether it's money or whether it's your time or whether it's your talents, you normally just don't give because you give. There's usually a reason to use your resources to benefit somebody else or something else. There's usually a reason. For example, we often give in response to need. Before our Moldova team went out this summer, they told us about the needs that they were going to meet when they got there. And so they appealed for our support, and they ran a couple of events, and many of you in church went along to those events, or you gave personal gifts to Joan or members of the team so that they could take that with them when they went. And you did that because the Moldova team had told us about the needs they were going to meet when they got there. And so I got a text from Joan yesterday, and here's what she says. She says, so far, we have renovated two family homes and had two outreach days, which were attended by over 200 adults and children. Eddie gave his testimony, and Abigail danced. It was a good job, wasn't the other way around, at one of the outreach days with six local people making a response. We are currently starting a new project at another family home and have also been presenting families with, wait for it, goats and chickens, giving them the opportunity to have milk, cheese, and eggs on a daily basis. The pencil cases, toys, and knitted items supplied by members of the congregation have been gratefully received and caused great excitement. We appreciate the prayers of everyone back home and will continue to show God's love to the people of Moldova during the rest of our stay. We didn't just give to the Moldova team for the sake of giving. We gave because we thought they could make a difference to people's lives. And they have done that. Three people are going to be living in homes now that are much more appropriate to their needs as parents and families than they were before our team went out. People have got goats and chickens. I don't know if you maybe wouldn't sort of think it was great to get a goat or a chicken, but in their terms, that's a bit like opening a Tesco store, because what it means is they can feed their children. And other people have received the gifts that we sent, the pencil cases and all those other things that are going to bless the lives of the people who got them. We gave because there was a need. And it's brilliant to be able to do that. But there are so many needs. And there is no end to the needs we're already committed to. We got, Christine and I got a letter last week from CAP, you know, we support regularly, and to saying how big the challenges are that they're facing at the moment and asking us if we could increase our giving to that need. If you support a charity or a Christian work, I'm sure you've had the phone call, you've had the letter, you know, because there is no end to the needs. And our problem is we can't always give to those needs because we've got to balance those needs against our own needs. We have children to feed, mortgages to pay, and petrol to put in the car, and you've got to balance that out against the needs of other people. So why would we commit to giving more if the only reason we have is to respond to need and we have needs ourselves? Paul says there is a reason to commit to more. There is a reason to commit to more, not just in terms of money, but in terms of all of our resources and our love and devotion to Jesus Christ. There is a reason to commit to more and a motivation to do so. And it's because of something much bigger and deeper and wider and significant than human need. See, what Paul is doing here is he is calling the Corinthians to commit to the mission of God. That's what's behind the offering for Jerusalem. He wasn't just asking people to commit to the needs of the poor in Jerusalem. Don't you think there was poor people in Corinth? Loads of the people in the fellowship in Corinth were poor. They were slaves. They didn't have any or many earthly possessions of any kind. And yet Paul is asking them to meet the needs of the people in Jerusalem. Why is he doing that? Well, he's doing that in response to something Jesus prayed. On the last night before he went to the cross, Jesus prayed. He prayed for us, for you and me, and for the disciples in the Corinthian church, everybody who would believe in him according to the testimony of the apostles. And this is what he prayed in John 17. I have given them, you and me, the glory that you gave me, that they may be one as we are one, I in them and you in me, so that they may be brought to complete unity. Then the world will know that you sent me and have loved them even as you have loved me. Paul was not asking the Corinthian Christians to commit to the Christians in Jerusalem to meet their needs. He was asking the Corinthian Christians to commit to the mission of God. Because in Jesus' prayer, he said, they will know, the world will know that you're for real and that I am for real when it sees you as the one people of God. When it sees the poor of Corinth taking what they can't afford to give and sending it to the poor in Jerusalem because you are part of the purposes of God in this generation. That's how the world will see and know that we are for real. Paul is not asking them to give to Jerusalem. He is asking them to commit to the mission. And the giving to Paul and Timothy is the same. He's not asking them to give to Paul and Timothy because they think Paul and Timothy are great. He's asking them to give to Paul and Timothy's needs so that they will be able to respond to the call of God. Paul and Timothy won't drive a better car or live in a nicer house or have a better lifestyle because the people in Corinth give to them. They will be set free to respond to wherever it is God wants them to go next. because he's asking them in Corinth to commit to the mission, and the giving is missional. You see, we will only ever begin to give as we ought, whether it's money or whether it's our time or whether it's opening up our home that it might be a hospitable place to run a discipleship community or to invite other people in. We will only give whatever it is that we are being called to give. We will only give it as we should and to the degree that we should when we commit to the mission and not to the giving itself. When the opportunity opened up for us to do something in the center of Belfast, and the presbytery had this opportunity, and because we've been running an Alpha course down there in the cathedral quarter, and they were looking for some way to plant a worshiping community down there, and we said, okay, well, we're already there with an Alpha course, maybe we could try, and we agreed that we would do that. We talked about it in Kirk Session, and we agreed, yes, this is something we should do, but I realized when we agreed to do that we would need money. We don't own any property down there, and so we were going to have to rent space in which to meet and worship, and space in that part of the town is very expensive. We were going to need some money to run events and publicize what we were doing, invite other people in. We were going to need money for a part-time salary for the person who was going to lead that. And I sat down, did a rough calculation, and reckoned that, well, I would need to find about £30,000 a year for the next 3 years. And we didn't have that. And I couldn't really go. I didn't feel the people who were already really seriously committed to helping us achieve our mission here and ask for more. So what were we going to do? We needed the money. We couldn't do the mission without the money. And just earlier in that year, just before Christmas, a friend of ours, he's a member of this church, a businessman, but he has been really admiring and supportive of some of the things that we have done. He had given a gift to the building, and in I had emailed him to thank him, and the email response to me, he said to me, John, it's no problem. If you're ever concerned about finance, about anything that you think God is calling you to do, I don't want you to be worried about that. Just get in touch with me, and if I can help you, I will. I had never done this before, ever. I'd never gone to an individual and said, look, we've got a need, and I need you to help me. So I summoned up courage, and I emailed him and said, hey, can I meet you? And he said, yes. So I went to meet him in his rather plush boardroom in his business, and we sat down, and I told him the vision. He said, God has opened a door, and a bit unexpected for us, and we have an opportunity to do something new in the center of Belfast and become a presence there before the university arrives and possibly build a new worshiping community in that place. But it's going to cost a lot of money, and we don't have the money. He said, how much do you think it will cost? And I laid it out to him, told him what I thought it would cost and what the needs would be for the next 3 years. And I explained to him why I thought this was really important and why I thought the Lord had done this thing. And I didn't know what to expect, really. You know, I kind of was scared up for the fact of him saying, well, that's really beyond me. I'm really sorry. I'd love to help you. But, or maybe him saying, well, that's really great. I'd love to get involved with that. I'll give you £5,000 or something to get you started. But after I had shared the vision with him and told him what the needs were and what we thought we could do if we could find the resources to do it, he looked me in the eye and he said, so when do you want the check? And I couldn't believe it. I was totally bowled over by it. And I said, are you sure? Which was a stupid thing to say in the circumstances, but you know. I said, are you sure? Yeah. He said, I'll need to rearrange some given that I have arranged. But he said, yeah, that'll be okay. I'll support you for the next 3 years. And if you need any more, come back and see me. Why did he give me £30,000 a year for 3 years? I don't know what it would feel like. I doubt if any of us in church this morning would know what it would feel like to have 30 grand spare that you could just give away like that, okay? You've never been in that position. You probably never will be. So it's really hard to figure out what it would feel like. But one thing I can be absolutely sure of, he didn't give me the 30 grand because it felt good. I'm pretty sure about that. Why did he do it? He did it because he saw the mission. He understood the vision. He thought, I can take money, just money, and I can use that money in such a way that it can make a difference to people's lives. People can find Jesus Christ. The worshiping community can be planted. Who knows how that area of the center of Belfast could be changed? And all I have to do to make that possible is to give money. He did it because he was committed to the mission and not because of the giving itself. We are not asked to commit to church to give our finances or our time or our talents so that we can pay the bills or so that we can pay the staff or so that we can fill the organizations with volunteers or so we can fill up our own spare time because we have nothing better to do with it. That is not why we give. And if we give for those kinds of reasons, we'll never give as we should, and we'll always give grudgingly. We are called to commit to the mission. And when we commit to the mission, then it gives that giving a context, a reason, and a motivation that will help us to give as we should. We're asked to commit. And secondly, we're asked to submit. Christians are called universally in the New Testament to submit to authority. Talking about earthly authority, Peter says in 1 Peter 2:13, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human authority, whether to the emperor, a supreme authority, and so on. He lists a number of other more minor authorities. So in the New Testament, Christians are frequently called to submit to public authority. Don't have to like the people, don't have to agree with the people, but we are called to submit to the regularly constituted authorities in life. We submit to them not because they're good, not even because they're right. We submit to them because that's who they are. But it's not the same in the church. This is really important that we get this. It's not the same in the church. Yes, the church, like the world, has structures. Everywhere Paul went, he left people like Timothy behind him so that they could appoint elders and set up structures to run these new congregations that were being planted through Paul's ministry. And they needed to be structured. They needed to have means to make decisions and all the rest of it. And Paul arranged for that. But here's the thing. However we understand what elders and deacons and bishops and pastors are, because they're all mentioned in the New Testament, however we understand them to be, and whatever we understand their functions to be, they are not to be respected just because of their appointment. The king or the queen, the prime minister or the president or whatever are to be respected, the New Testament says, because they are the king or queen, the president, the prime minister, whatever, all right? But that is not true of leadership in the church. They're not to be respected just because they've got the badge. Paul says to the Thessalonians, 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 12, now we ask you, brothers and sisters, to acknowledge those who work hard among you, who care for you in the Lord, and who admonish you. Hold them in the highest regard in love because of their work. That respect has to be earned. In leadership, in the life of a local fellowship, who do you follow? You follow people who demonstrated that they are committed to the mission, that their lives are aligned with that commitment, and that everything they do, it's so obvious that that's what means the most to them. I was at the Click and Collect at Tesco on Friday picking up our shopping, and I wasn't on our usual slot. So the woman who's usually there when I go, she wasn't there. She must have finished for the day. And there's a couple of guys on whom I've never met before. So if you've done Click and Collect at Tesco's, you know the deal. You go along, they ask you your name, and they find your sheet and so on. So I said my name, John Dickinson. Oh, he said. Now, in my experience in life, that's never a good sign. All right, so we went and he got the form and I signed it. And then he came over to me. I was kind of putting stuff into the bag. He said, you've got any spare bags there? I could help you. And so I said, yeah. And so he got the bags out of the boot. Really helpful wee man. He was going ahead loading stuff into the bags. And he said to me, John Dickinson. I thought, here it comes. John Dickinson, Carnmoney Church. I said, yeah. And then he said, you guys are doing a great work up there. I don't think he was talking about me. I think he was talking about you. I haven't met the man. I don't know who he is. I don't know how he knows about us. I don't know if we've helped him through our uniform ministry or through our cap ministry or in some other way. I don't know if some of his family came to faith here. I have no idea. But what he said about us was this. I respect you because of what you do. You guys are doing a great work up there. And that's what Paul is saying here about this guy, Stephanas. You know the household of Stephanas were the first converts in Achaia, and they have devoted themselves to the service of the Lord's people. I urge you, brothers and sisters, to submit to such people and to everyone who joins in the work and labors at it. People who are to be respected in the life of the fellowship are the people who are committed to the mission and who show it by how they live their lives. Not because they've got a badge, not because some presbytery ordained them or appointed them, not because the Kirk session said they could be a leader in an organization, but because their lives show what it means to be committed to the mission because of their work. I was listening while I was off to some of the sessions from the leadership conference in London this year, and I was listening to a session where Nicky Gumbel was interviewing a particular person, and he was talking about the process by which people join the Navy SEALs in the United States. You may know the Navy SEALs are probably the kind of the ultimate in terms of the American Armed Forces, and there's a really, really high standard to qualify to become a Navy SEAL. It involves going on a number of kind of assessments and so on, in which people are tested to the absolute limit during the program. And this particular person was talking about the process, and what he said was, do you know who it is who normally gets selected to become Navy SEALs? Okay, it's not the person who is the leadership guru who knows how to hand everything on, delegate things to everybody else. And everybody thinks he's a really clever leader because he can do that. Normally, they don't make it out of the process. It's not the Ivy League students who got straight grade A's in everything and are really, really intelligent. It's not the sports majors who are really fit and disciplined and who know how to make the best of the physical gifting that they have. And it's not the people whose muscles are so big you could see them from a satellite in space. He said the people who get selected on the Navy SEAL program are the people who have come to the very end of all their human resources. They are absolutely exhausted and emotionally drained, and they have nothing left to give. But somehow or other, having reached that point of absolute exhaustion, they dig deeper inside themselves to help the person beside them. They are the people who make it through the Navy SEAL course and who get selected to serve. And that's what Jesus did, isn't it? We don't submit to him and love him just because he's the Lord and he's entitled to our loyalty. He is the creator of the ends of the earth. Everything that was made, he made. He has the power and authority to snuff it out tomorrow at the click of his fingers if he chose to do so. We do not love him and submit to him and give him all our allegiance just because that's who he is. We do it because he's not just the Lord. He's also the Lamb. And at the end of all his earthly resources, he gave everything he had for you and me. And that's why we love him. And that's why we serve him. And that's why we submit to him. And Paul said, that's the same standard I'm looking for in people who should lead the local church. That's what you should look for if you're looking for somebody to follow. And that's who Stephanas really was. He gave his resources to bless the local fellowship. And because of that, Paul says, submit to people like that. Not because he's got a badge, not because somebody ordained him and placed him in a position of leadership, but because of what he does. We are called in the Church of Jesus Christ to commit to the mission. And people who really commit to the mission, who give themselves, who dig deep beyond even what their own resources will allow them to do, who dig deep so that the mission might succeed, those are the people whom we should follow. and to whom we should submit. You know, loads of times in church life, we got it completely wrong. Loads of times we think it's all about qualifications and training and all that sort of stuff, nice people that we can trust and all the rest of it. And those are the people we appoint to lead, and loads of times those are really good people, and often they do really good jobs. But that's not what Paul says real Christian leadership is about. Real Christian leadership is also often about people who are not qualified, who have no training, who bring very little to the table in terms of what they have, in terms of personal human resources. But they are people who are prepared to give to the mission because they're committed to it. I don't listen to Patricia Scullin because she is a qualified accountant. She doesn't have a financial background at all. I don't listen to her because she pesters me nearly every day in life with a telephone call about something to do with the wretched finances of this church. I listen to her because of the emails at 3 o'clock in the morning after a really busy day at work, when I realized that she sat up into the small hours to try to get things ready for a committee meeting or to get the end of year figures done. And I don't listen to her because she pesters me and tells me I can't spend money on a certain thing because of her economic qualifications. I listen to her because of all the things Patricia has ever questioned when it's come to money in this church. She has never, ever once questioned the mission. If she says we don't have the money, it's because we don't have the money. It's not because she's not willing to spend it on something she thinks the Lord wants us to do. See, that's the kind of leadership. And she's not here this morning, so I'm not embarrassing her. She's away, that's fine. That's the kind of leadership that Paul is talking about here. Committed to the mission, demonstrating it by how they live their lives. It could be anybody, really. You don't need the education and the qualifications. You don't need any of that stuff. Be a leader in the Church of Christ. You just need to be committed to the mission and show it by how you live.